Eh bien, j'ai le grand plaisir d'introduire aujourd'hui notre invitée, Stacy Friend, qui est invitée par l'Assemblée des professeurs du Collège de France pour cette série de conférences, de deux conférences, donc aujourd'hui et la semaine prochaine, au même endroit, à la même heure, pour des conférences sur la fiction, qui est à la fois le thème des activités de ma chaire cette année, et aussi le thème de prédilection des recherches de Stacy Friend, qui est bien connue pour ses travaux, en grande partie sur la littérature, plus généralement sur la fiction, sur la référence dans la fiction comme genre, l'imagination, toutes sortes de thèmes qui nous retiennent cette année. Stacy est la présidente de la Société britannique d'esthétique, et elle enseigne à l'Université de Londres, à Birkbeck College. L'Université de Londres est divisée en collèges. Et elle est aussi la responsable de la revue philosophique bien connue Analysis. Et outre les conférences qu'elle va prononcer, donc ses conférences en anglais, ces deux conférences en anglais sur la fiction et le monde qui commencent aujourd'hui, elle prononcera aussi, elle aura l'occasion d'intervenir à deux reprises au Collège de France, et cette fois en français, à la fois dans le séminaire qui suit mon cours le vendredi après-midi, et son exposé, ça n'est pas demain, mais la semaine prochaine, et aussi dans une table ronde sur la fiction qui réunira un certain nombre d'intervenants, dont elle, et aussi quelques professeurs du Collège de France et quelques personnalités extérieures, dont une table ronde sur les frontières de la fiction, et ça aura lieu le lundi 21 février, je crois, l'après-midi, dans l'amphi Marguerite de Navarre. Alors, au Collège de France, il y a une tradition pour les professeurs invités par l'Assemblée à faire un site de conférence, c'est que ces professeurs reçoivent la médaille du Collège de France, et donc c'est un grand plaisir de remettre à Stacy la médaille en question.
Merci. Avant de commencer, je voudrais m'excuser de donner ces conférences en anglais. Je parais plus intelligente en anglais, ça c'est la raison. Et je veux remercier l'Assemblée du Collège de France et en particulier le professeur François Racanati de m'avoir invité. And now I start in English. Right? Again, I'm very honored to be here and I'd like to thank the Assembly of the Collège de France and also François Racanati for having invited me. So as Professor Racanati said, in this lecture and next week, I'll be talking about the relationship between fiction and the world. And so the first thing to do, I think, is to say something about what I mean by the term fiction in this context. So there are two different uses of the term that are fairly common, not just in the academy, but in ordinary language. The first treats something as fiction if it's unreal or untrue or invented. So this can include things that don't exist. For example, Santa Claus or fairies or what have you. Right? Or it can include claims that are false, perhaps the claims that some politicians make, or just ordinary lies. We might say the testimony of a criminal, for example, is just a fiction, okay, so in this sense. And the contrast here is between what is fiction and what is true, or what is real, or what are the facts. Okay, so that's one way of using the term fiction. It's not the primary way that I'm going to use the term fiction here. My focus will instead be on fiction in the sense of works of fiction, right? A particular kind of representational artwork. The paradigm instances are works of literature or film, although I will be focusing primarily in what follows on works of literature. And the contrast here is not, as I will in fact be arguing, with what's real or true or factual, but with nonfiction, another genre of representational artworks. Right? So that's the basic contrast that I'll be working with. Now, although I have just very carefully tried to distinguish between fiction in the sense of what is untrue, right, and non-factual, with fiction in the sense of a work in fiction, they're often run together, so that the distinction between works of fiction and works of non-fiction is frequently reduced to a kind of distinction between fiction on the one hand and facts or reality on the other. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but one reason is an idea, an assumption, that nonfictions, works of nonfiction, are essentially, in some sense, factual. They aim at the truth, even if they don't always achieve it. They refer to real individuals and events. Their job is to convey information. Their aim is to prompt beliefs concerning the real world. The basic idea here is that we read nonfiction to find out what's going on or what has happened, okay, or what will happen. By contrast, works of fiction are treated differently. We think of them as entertaining us. They invite us to imagine what is unreal or non-existent or never happened. We don't look at them as sources of information. Rather than telling us the truth, they convey what are called fictional truths, a topic I'll return to shortly, and perhaps concern fictional worlds, right? Or for some theorists of past decades, perhaps just alluding to other texts, but in any case, not referring to the actual world around us. So these are kind of common background assumptions that motivate the idea that we can contrast works of fiction in some sense with what is factual. And this is exactly the contrast that I'm going to be criticizing. Now, one way in which these assumptions play out within particularly analytic philosophy is the idea that truth and falsity are somehow irrelevant to fiction. So the logician and mathematician, Gottlob Frege, at the end of the 19th century, took fictions as a primary example of a source of things like proper names, for example, Odysseus, which was one of his favorite examples, that fail to refer. And he said that rather than being concerned with the truth or falsity of what we read in literature or in poetry, we care about sense rather than reference, meaning, connotation, imagery, the beauty of the language. We set aside our concern with what is true and what is false. And that was a pretty influential view that it continues to hold some sway. More recently, and related to some ideas of Frege, but not directly influenced by him, a lot of philosophers have taken fiction to essentially involve a kind of pretense. This is a non-deceptive pretense. So, when an author of fiction sets down to write what they're saying, they are pretending, perhaps, to be a particular character who's narrating a story. They are pretending to tell you the truth about events of which they have knowledge. But of course, none of that is true, and you know it, so it's not deceptive. But it is a mere pretense. And insofar as it's supposed to be a mere pretense, again, the question of truth or falsity doesn't seem to arise, because we know it's a pretense, we don't ask, is it true or is it false? Right? So that's one strand of thought that's developed from these assumptions. In a different domain, although related to analytic philosophy, there is an idea that fictions generate some kind of alternative world. So this idea emerges originally from the philosopher David Lewis, who discussed the idea of fiction and truth in fiction in terms of fiction at other worlds, what he called possible worlds. And this idea has had significant influence, particularly in the domain of narratology. Right? These are just a couple of examples of books about this topic. The idea is that fictions are not about the real world, except perhaps in a very indirect sense. Right? So, and it's not simply that talking about fictional worlds is a colorful way of talking about ways the ways the world might be, but actually, let's think, they say, of fictional worlds as other possible worlds, right? So these are worlds that are alternatives to our reality, ontologically the same kind of thing, right? Concrete alternative realities with their own populations and histories and events that are unfolding. And the idea is that fiction can be construed as giving us a certain kind of access, you might say, to these other possible worlds. In this way of thinking, the idea is also that when works of fiction might appear to be talking about real individuals and events, it's better to think of those as talking about counterparts of real individuals and events, occupants of these other worlds. So when you have a work like War and Peace, where you find out about Napoleon and Russia alongside the fictional characters, these are not really Napoleon or Russia. These are the occupants of these other worlds, counterparts of Napoleon and Russia. And so the idea behind this is that when we engage with fiction, we're getting a grip on some other world, right? The fictional world. Okay. And that means that we leave the real world behind when we appreciate fiction. Now, this is a very rough characterization of these kinds of views, which are far more subtle than I'm putting out, but that's a kind of general idea that I want to contest. If we adopt these approaches, right, if we don't think of works of fiction as being about the real world, if we think that truth and falsity are in some sense irrelevant to thinking about fiction, we face a variety of puzzles, and indeed these are the puzzles that have exercised philosophers for some time. Right, what are fictions about? Right, what are fictional worlds? What really are possible worlds? Right, what could we be talking about there? Why do we criticize some works of fiction for misrepresentation? It's very common, particularly since the advent of the internet, when anyone can figure out what's gone wrong and what's inaccurate about any particular work, right, to discover that there is a great deal of criticism of works of literature, as well as films, for their inaccuracies and misrepresentations, in particular historical fictions that get basic facts wrong, that are anachronistic, works that are perhaps stereotypically racist or sexist in certain ways that we call out as being misguided. Okay. So what's the point of that kind of criticism if fictions are about other worlds that have nothing to do with this world? Now, I think I should note, and I'll come back to this point, that we don't always criticize works of fiction, obviously, for departing from the real world. And so the question is going to be, why do we do so in some cases and not in others? Why do we care about fictional characters and events? Right? After all, they're not real. They don't exist. Or they're only real in some other place. Okay. Why do we get emotionally involved in them? One of the great values of engaging with great works of literature is surely our emotional involvement with the characters. We care about what happens to them, or we would stop reading. And it's hard to explain that if these characters are nothing to do with us, as it were. And how do we learn from fiction? It looks like, and many theorists have claimed, that we can deepen our understanding, broaden our horizon, gain new perspectives, understand other people's experiences, right? These are claims that are frequently made about the cognitive value of engaging with fictional works. But it's a bit mysterious how that happens if these works don't have anything to do with the real world, can't be true or false, and so on. So these are the kinds of puzzles that arise when we start thinking that fiction is somehow severed from reality and the real world. And my view is that rather than trying to bridge that gap, we should deny it. We should just deny that fictions aren't about the real world and don't concern truth and falsity. So the picture that I want to put forward, as I just said, is that works of fiction, just like works of nonfiction, are about the real world, although they ask us to imagine the real world to be different in various respects than it actually is. And so the interesting thing about fiction is, what's the value of imagining the real world to be different in these respects? The idea, then, is that appreciation, or so I'll argue, requires attention to truth and falsity. We think of fictions, or I think we think of fictions, as anchored in the real world, with interesting questions about how far they depart along various dimensions, but always still coming back to that real world grounding. Now, I don't deny that we contrast fictional worlds with the real world. We say, in the world of this fiction, such and such occurs. Right? I just say that that's a colorful way of saying something about the same world. These are different ways of thinking about the same world at the end of the day. So today I'm going to defend this picture, okay? And then next time I'm going to talk about some of the consequences, some of the advantages of thinking this way about fiction. Okay, so let me start by returning to the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. I want to say, just to start without getting theoretical, that on the face of it, it simply looks false that works of fiction don't refer aren't occasionally true and false, and so on. Right? I think it's fairly obvious that on the one hand, many works of fiction contain truths, refer to real individual and events, and invite beliefs. So Eugénie Grandet takes place in Saumur, which is a real place, as you may know, in France. Le Père Goriot takes place right here in Paris. War and Peace has chapters containing information about detailed battles during the Napoleonic invasion of Russia. Adichie's Half of a Yellow Sun gives an accurate account of the experiences of people during the Nigerian Civil War. Okay, so these works not only do have truths contained in them, not only do refer to real individuals and events, but in various respects are designed to tell us something about those as well, to inform us in various ways about those real individuals and events. So that's on the side of fiction, right? Fictions can be true, they can refer, and so on. On the other side of the coin, many non-fictions can be false. And I don't just mean they can, it's obvious they can be false unintentionally, right? Or intentionally to deceive, we all know that. But they can also be false intentionally without any intent to deceive. There are works of nonfiction that, as we might say, fiddle around with the facts for various purposes. So in Cold Blood, Truman Capote massaged certain facts in various ways in order to create a literary narrative that would resemble a fiction, even though it's grounded almost completely in facts, or so he claimed. In classical Greece and Rome, histories systematically include invented battle scenes and invented speeches. In fact, this was one of the valuable features of history as written at the time. So Tacitus was praised for his brilliant style in creating these battle scenes and these speeches, right, which don't resemble what actually happened. He didn't actually know what actually happened. And so that was not meant to deceive. Anyone who's aware of the conventions of writing history at the time will recognize what's going on. Right? And so works of nonfiction contain things that are made up without being deceptive. So we can't distinguish fiction and nonfiction just in those kinds of terms, in terms of intentional truth or falsity. Now, this doesn't mean, as some people have concluded, that the difference between fiction and nonfiction is unimportant. It can be very important while being complicated to define the two and finding it hard to distinguish, right? The difference between genuine love and mere infatuation is very difficult to define, but also extremely important. So there are lots of things that are hard to define but are important, so that's not the problem. It doesn't mean that everything is fiction, what the narratologist Marie-Laure Ryan calls pan-fictionalism, which was a common view in historiography some decades ago and still has some influence. Ryan doesn't agree with it, just for the record. It doesn't mean everything is fiction because non-fictions contain some falsehoods that are intentional. Instead, it just means that the contrast is complicated, right? It's a question of defining different genres. And for anyone who's thought about differences among literary genres, that's a complicated question involving many factors. Okay. Now, I want to say that although it is complicated, and I'm not going to give a definition of fiction versus nonfiction here because it's just going to take us too far afield, and I'm just going to be primarily talking about works of fiction that everyone will agree are works of fiction in what follows. A work's fictionality and its particular genre will matter to our appreciation. It'll matter to us whether a work is fiction or nonfiction, right? And it'll matter to us whether it's a history or historical fiction, right? Or a fantasy or what have you, in various ways. The point that I want to make without getting into all of those details is that we can't simply assume or stipulate from the outset that works of fiction fail to be about the real world or that truth or falsity are irrelevant. Okay. And that's all I'm going to say about the distinction, and I hope you'll go along with my assumption that it is at least possible that works of fiction can be about the real world, that that's not excluded by definition of fiction. And so that's the idea that I want to argue for. One reason to think that that's right is to recognize why reference and truth can matter when we appreciate fictions. So, as I said before, we often value accuracy and criticize misrepresentation. So we can contrast a couple of historical fictions by British authors as an example. Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, as well as the subsequent novels in her trilogy, is widely praised for the phenomenal degree of research that she undertook in order to get the details of life in Tudor times, particularly pertaining to the life of Thomas Cromwell, which is the subject of the novels, to get them accurate. She spent 5 years researching the details to the extent that no character is in a location that they couldn't have been, given the locations we know they were at other times, for example. So it's that level of accuracy. Now, naturally, that's not necessary. One doesn't have to do that when one writes a work of fiction, right? Nonetheless, it's generally considered to be a virtue of this novel. It's a part of the achievement of Mantel that she managed to do that. So certainly the case that we can praise these kinds of accuracy. On the other side of the coin, the novels of Philippa Gregory, perhaps the most famous is The Other Boleyn Girl, which is a well-known film as well, have been panned by critics and historians for their inaccuracies. In The Other Boleyn Girl, in particular, the portrayal of Anne Boleyn is widely considered to be completely misleading in various respects, and has been quite influential. A lot of people have this image of Anne Boleyn in mind because of the popularity of the film in particular. And so Gregory is criticized for this kind of inaccuracy. Now, I think it's important to mention, because the claim is typically not simply that we don't care about truth, but that we don't care about truth value, that is, whether or not something is true or false in fiction. And I want to say that falsity also matters. That is, we register when something is false in various respects. And that can have important effects. On the most basic level, when something is obviously false in a work of fiction, it kind of informs us that the fiction departs from reality in this respect or the other. I'll come back to that. But there are other more particular effects that occur through falsity and reference, particularly when you have reference to real individuals. All right, so Laurent Binet's The Seventh Function of Language, for example, is an excellent example of a work which, if you're interested in the Collège de France and literature, you should certainly read. And in this work, the premise is that Roland Barthes, his accident, he was killed when he was hit by a laundry van, was not an accident, but a murder involving a great deal of political intrigue and many, many literary theorists as well. The people who traipse through the pages of this novel include Foucault and Mitterrand, and they are caricatures, let's say, of these individuals based on the reality in amusing ways, but clearly departing from it. And it's very, very funny. Right? And it's funny partly because you know who they are and you can see the ways in which the truth is being distorted. Okay. And I think, so that's a case where we're talking about real individuals being represented or misrepresented in various ways. But I think fictions, perhaps even more importantly, generally are construed to represent types. So it matters to us whether or not those types are accurate, right? If you think about Balzac's La Comédie Humaine, in fact, that's the whole purpose of La Comédie Humaine, is to give you a sense of all the types existing across French society, right? A lot of them in Paris, generally the worst ones, sorry, but also in the provinces and all over the country in various locations. And a more recent example is Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other, which takes 12 fictional women, but from all different walks of life, primarily in the UK, to give you a sense of the different kinds of experiences of women over the past decades in the UK. And Evaristo's novel is widely praised for giving people a sense of the experience of people of that kind, right? And so here we're very interested in accuracy or truth concerning the types of people who populate these fictions. Now, as I said before, the standard idea is that rather than recognizing the importance of truth, what we get from works of fiction is instead something that's called fictional truth. So I want to consider the idea of fictional truth, which in itself is not a problem, but when contrasted with truth can be a difficulty. So fictional truth is just the idea of what is so according to a story, right? What is the case? What obtains in the world of the fiction? And we can put this in terms of various claims. Some fictional truths are explicit, right? So in Virginia Woolf's novel, Clarissa Dalloway is planning a party. In fact, that's pretty much the plot of Mrs. Dalloway. A great deal more occurs, but most of it occurs in different people's minds while she's planning the party. Right? In Les Miserables, Jean Valjean was imprisoned for stealing bread. Right? That's pretty much a very significant fact that influences everything that happens subsequently. And that's explicit in the novel. But the majority of fictional truths are really implicit. They're inferred. So in Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, the main character, Okonkwo, feels guilty about killing his adopted son, Ikemefuma. And he never says so. He himself doesn't acknowledge it. No one ever talks about it. But you infer it from your knowledge of ordinary human behavior and what happens to him after. Right? If you read Lolita, you should infer that Humbert is deceptive. So when he tells you that Lolita seduced him willingly, you should take that with a very large grain of salt, right? That is not actually the case. And so we're given an explicit text, but we make inferences that go beyond the text and sometimes contradict what's actually explicit. So that's the idea of fictional truth. Now, critics are typically interested in controversial claims about fictional truth, the kind that lead to debates about interpretation. Why does Hamlet hesitate to kill Claudius, right? The amount of ink spilt on this question is very large. Who is Godot? Why are Vladimir and Estragon waiting for him, or it, or whatever Godot turns out to be? Is Hercule Poirot correct in his conclusion that Dr. Shepherd murdered Roger Ackroyd in the Agatha Christie novel? Or should we buy into the alternative solution offered by the critic Pierre Bayard in Qui a tué Roger Ackroyd? Which, if you like Christie, you should also read. I'm a list of recommendations. Okay. Now, by contrast, philosophers are more interested in the boring, uncontroversial fictional truths. This is one of the reasons that people who are interested in literature read some things that philosophers say and cannot believe the amount of time we're spending on claims like, coming from David Lewis, Sherlock Holmes does not have a third nostril and never visited the moons of Saturn. Now, why are philosophers so interested in these uncontroversial fictional truths? Well, precisely because they are so uncontroversial. Precisely because we all agree. It's obvious, right? It is absolutely obvious, although nothing in the Sherlock Holmes stories explicitly says anything about this, but it is obvious to us that that's the case, that obtains in the story. But why are we so sure? What is it that we've latched onto that makes us so confident, right, that this is the case? So in the cases when we are confident, what is justifying that? Philosophers focusing on this issue ask two questions about fictional truth. The first is, what does it mean to say that something is fictionally true? And I am now, henceforth, going to replace that term with a different one that I prefer. I'm going to ask, what is storified? And my reason for doing that is that there is no good reason to think that what is fictionally true is any kind of truth. Right? And we want to distinguish between what is true in the sense of true in the real world and what obtains in a fiction, which I'll call what is storified. So what does it mean to say that something is storified or isn't? And the other question they ask is how we determine what is storified, at least in the cases that we can determine this, right? This is often asked following the philosopher Kendall Walton, by asking, what are the principles of generation for fictional truth? What are the rules that take us from what is explicit to the rest of what obtains in a story? Now, as I've said, right, what is storified, or the notion of fictional truth? It's not the same as being true, at least in the actual world. Although some of what is storified is also true. So in War and Peace, as in Tolstoy's other novels, Russian aristocrats speak French. And that's also true. It was true in the real world that Russian aristocrats spoke French. But it's not true for this, it's not fictionally true or storified for the same reason. It's storified because Tolstoy presents the characters as speaking French in the novel. Okay. Rather, what is storified is what obtains in the, as we say, colorfully in the fictional world, just according to the story. Not just what is explicit, but as I've said, also the rest that fills in the gaps in what is explicit. Now, we can take this literally. After all, when we fill in those gaps, we think of the fictional characters and events as existing beyond the page in some sense. There's more to them than what we're told, or so at least it seems to us. So we could take that literally and say, what is storified is what obtains at some other world, in some possible world, for example. But I don't think this is right. But more importantly, for present purposes, I don't think it's illuminating. After all, we don't have access to other possible worlds, in any case, to find out what's going on in these other worlds. It's better, therefore, to say that we imagine story worlds. Right? When we read a fiction, we imagine what's going on. We imagine that there's more to it than what we read. And what is storified, then, is what obtains in the worlds we imagine. Okay? Now, if I'm going to avoid thinking of that as engaging with other worlds, I have to give an account of what it means to imagine a story world. And here I'm just going to borrow from the psychology of narrative comprehension, according to which imagining a story world or representing the events and individuals in a story more generally means constructing a mental model or a situation model. Those are the terms that are used in the literature. What is that? It's a kind of mental microworld of what the story is about, a dynamic, multidimensional mental representation of the situations described by the text, including representations of people, objects, properties, relations, the unfolding of events. You open the book, you're introduced to a character, you form a mental representation of the character, you're told something about them, you start to increase the amount of information in your representation, and pretty soon you have a world in your mind. That's the idea. Now, we construct situation models, right, according to the psychologists, to understand narratives, whether or not they're fiction. So fiction and nonfiction narratives, we understand similarly, indeed very much, very many texts we understand in this way, by constructing a complex mental representation of what's going on. When we believe what we read, right, so in the case of nonfiction that we take to be reliable, for example, we incorporate representations from this situation model into our beliefs. That's the basic idea. So we form a model in our minds, reading a work of nonfiction, of, say, the history of a particular war, and then we take the information from that model and we put it into our beliefs. But when we imagine a story world in response to fiction, many of the representations will be things we don't believe. Right? We don't believe many of the characters existed. We don't believe all the events have happened. And in that case, the representations will remain compartmentalized within the model. Okay, this is just borrowing terminology from the psychologists who talk about this. And the idea then is that to imagine a story world, to imagine a fictional world, a world that we don't take to be exactly the same as the real world, just means formulating this mental representation and keeping it compartmentalized, right? Not allowing it to influence our actions and so on. This happens when, again, when we have, say, fictional characters whom we take to represent real types. So when I read the Evaristo novel and I take the character Ama to be a representative of a black woman in London trying to succeed in the theater. That's what she's doing, right? I keep compartmentalized the information about the specifics of Amma's life, right? But I may incorporate all kinds of information about the theater world in London and the difficulties faced by people like Amma. Okay, so that's just how we traffic when we imagine story worlds. So the question then is going to be, how do we fill in the story world that we imagine? How do we fill in those gaps in order to understand the story and represent what's going on? So filling in the gaps requires background knowledge. And I want to say that the most basic knowledge that it requires is just going to be ordinary background knowledge of the facts. So here's an illustration from the early days of artificial intelligence research. Okay, so this was a program called Tailspin that was supposed to generate stories along the lines of Aesop's fables. And it was given the first few sentences of a story and told to continue. Okay, the bolded sentence is the continuation. The story begins, "One day Joe Bear was hungry. He asked his friend Irving Bird where some honey was. Irving told him there was a beehive in the oak tree." Okay, and the computer came up with, "Joe threatened to hit Irving if he didn't tell him where some honey was." So the programmers entered the information that beehives contain honey, which was obviously missing in the first version. And then the program gave this sentence, "Joe walked to the oak tree. He ate the beehive." Now, you could spend literally years attempting to program a computer by inserting all of the background information that's clearly required to understand the most basic events that occur in a story. This is just an illustration of how basic is our reliance on what is actually the case in order to understand stories. And in light of this kind of case and many others, a plausible view is that the background for story worlds is supplied by the real world. And Marie-Laure Ryan calls this the principle of minimal departure. So we think about the background being the real world, and then we only depart as much as we need to from that background in order to understand the story. My version of this idea is what I call the reality assumption. Okay. So here's how we start out when we read a work of fiction. You assume everything that's really true is storified. More generally, that anything that obtains in the real world also obtains, as it were, in the fictional world, or can be represented in your situation model. And you adjust that presumption only as needed. Right? So the basic idea is you just assume the story takes place in the real world. Okay? And you then adjust this presumption as you go along and you're required to do so. That's the basic idea. Why do you adjust the presumption? Well, it's pretty obvious there are a number of reasons why you do when you read fiction. First, there might be explicit, reliable content that contradicts reality. Right? So right there at the beginning of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Earth and almost all humans are destroyed by some aliens, right? Because the Earth had failed to get a permit to be located in that particular place in space, and therefore had to be destroyed by alien bureaucrats, essentially. And of course, that contradicts reality, and so you know that we should adjust the reality assumption as far as that goes. Genre conventions are another reason to adjust the presumption that everything is just like it is in the real world, right? You know, to borrow another example of David Lewis's, that if you're reading a fairy tale and there's a dragon, you can, in most cases, infer that the dragon breathes fire, even if this is never stated, right? And that's because you understand the conventions of these kinds of stories. There are contrary belief systems that require you to drop some of your expectations of the truth. So a great deal of what happens in Dante's Divine Comedy, for example, relies on a medieval Catholic worldview, which, if you don't know some of the details of that, there will be a lot that you don't understand. And depending on your interpretive leanings, facts about authorial intention might give you a reason to adjust the presumption that you're exactly in the real world, right? So Henry James's The Turn of the Screw was intended by James to be a ghost story. Later critics like Ernest Jones argue that there was a Freudian interpretation according to which the narrator is actually sexually repressed and therefore delusional, so there are no real ghosts in the story. Now, the delusional interpretation is closer to reality on the assumption that there are no ghosts. Okay? But if you go by James's intention, treat it as a ghost story, okay, that's a reason to adjust the presumption. The important point that I want to make is that we assume that whatever other aspects of reality remain consistent with what you've adjusted, remain the case, and we rely on that in making further inferences. That is, we don't ever drop the assumption that everything else remains the same. And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a really good example. You have to throw out the laws of physics in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because they clearly do not obtain. But you don't throw out the laws of psychology. The story would be incomprehensible if you didn't assume that not only the human characters, but actually the aliens, all have desires and goals and beliefs and fall in love and do all of these kinds of things. In fact, the story is very mundane psychologically, right? So you retain the assumption that the world of the story, no matter how different in various respects, remains the same as in the real world in other respects. And you use that to make these inferences. Now, the reality assumption doesn't tell us how to make the inferences. It's compatible with lots of different ways of interpreting things. Okay? It just says that by default, we are, from the start, invited to represent, as part of the story world we imagine, anything that obtains in the real world that isn't excluded by the explicit content, the genre, authorial intention, and whatever interpretive assumptions that you're making. It's a kind of bias in favor of reality. That's the idea. Now, when we exclude any such representations, that's when we exclude, say, the laws of physics from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the rejection of those representations will, as I put it, be localized and by domain. Okay. That means, for example, that when we exclude facts about the laws of physics, when we're dealing with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right, that doesn't just mean anything goes. You might think it means anything goes. After all, there are contradictions in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You can eat at a restaurant and watch the universe collapse and regenerate from the window. So, you might think anything goes in that world, but no. Actually, we stick to assuming the psychological laws are the same, we stick to assuming that people walk in the same way and so on. Okay. So, those exclusions are localized. And similarly, when we read a fiction that introduces fictional characters, like, say, Ivan Denisovich in Solzhenitsyn's novel, right, we therefore exclude ordinary facts about who exists. We know that we're going to have to expect that there are people and events in this world that are different from the ones in reality. Okay? But we still don't exclude facts about the types of people and the types of events, the types of institutions. Right? The whole point of Solzhenitsyn's novel is to give us a fictional character, Ivan Denisovich, who experiences his day, which gives us a sense of the ordinary circumstances, I've said that, the ordinary circumstances of prisoners in the gulag. So no actual prisoner has experienced all these things in one day, but actual prisoners have experienced all these things at some point. That's the idea. And so even though we recognize that the people in the novel aren't the same as the real people who exist, we nonetheless take ourselves to be dealing with real types. And therefore, if you know something about the Soviet gulag system, you bring that to bear in understanding the story, and you incorporate information from the story into your beliefs. Now, there's a lot of empirical evidence in psychology that we operate with something like the reality assumption, that we operate when we understand fictions by assuming that we're dealing with the real world. I'm not going to get into detail and be happy to tell people about this in more detail at some point, So there are studies that show that readers automatically use prior knowledge to make emotional and spatial inferences, where the capacity to do this is independent of other cognitive abilities. So for example, people can tell how a character is feeling. They make this inference very automatically, even if they have poor reading comprehension in other respects, or they have good reading comprehension, or what have you, or they're native speakers, or they're not native speakers. They all make this inference automatically just based on their ordinary knowledge of how humans feel in certain situations. Other studies show that readers take unrelated facts about the real world to obtain in fictional worlds. So Dina Skolnick-Weisberg and Joshua Goodstein ran a study in which they presented people with different stories, and then they gave them a list of truths about the real world and asked them which of them were also the case in these fictional worlds. And by and large, readers took ordinary facts about the real world to be true in the fictional world, even when they had nothing to do with the story. For example, mathematical facts were thought to be true in all the fictions and so on. And it also is the case that when you change the background assumptions of a story sufficiently, readers have enormous difficulty comprehending the most basic facts about the plot. So in this study by Gresser and colleagues, they used the novel Einstein's Dreams, in which in different chapters, Einstein dreams that time operates in a different way from the way that it does. For example, going in a circle or going backwards. And they found that readers couldn't understand what was going on in the story when that background assumption was shifted significantly, right? Or at least they had a great deal of difficulty. Okay. Now, the reality assumption, right, which is the claim I'm defending in order to motivate the idea that the real world is our grounding for fiction, might gain some empirical support from these kinds of studies and from the intuitive motivations I've tried to give. So let's suppose that readers do rely subconsciously on the reality assumption when they fill in the gaps to understand a story. It doesn't follow that they should do this. The reality assumption is a normative claim. It says this is how you're supposed to do things. It doesn't just say, right, here's what we do. It says start out by thinking you're in the real world and then figure out what's going on. And as it happens, there are many objections to the reality assumption in the literature, which I have been fending off for some time, and so have others. I'm not going to go through all the objections to the reality assumption, but I'm going to give you a couple because I think it's important not only to defend it, but also to show how it works in practice. All right, so one objection is that the reality assumption looks like it only makes sense for realistic fictions, right? Fictions which arguably are obviously set in some sense in the real world. But if you have an unrealistic story, the departures from the reality assumption, the number of adjustments you'll have to make, will be so pervasive that it isn't really a useful way of thinking. Perhaps then, prior to reading a work of fiction, we should just assume that anything at all can be true, right? Start out with a blank slate. Think to yourself, I have no idea what's going to come. Okay, don't start with the real world background and all that. Just see what happens. Okay. I don't think that this is at all plausible. And the reason is that genre conventions, although they can tell us very specific ways in which works depart from the truth, they're too limited in scope to generate most of what is storified. So I'll just give you an example from the Grimm's fairy tale, The Frog Prince. So at the beginning of The Frog Prince, a princess loses her golden ball down a well. The frog offers to get it back for her in exchange for a kiss. Okay? He does obtain the ball, but then she runs away, and many antics ensue as a consequence of these events. This is an unrealistic world, I take it, in which frogs speak and so on, and then eventually turn out to be princes. However, readers have no difficulty understanding, one, why can't the princess get the ball? Why can a frog get the ball? Why doesn't the princess want to kiss the frog? Right? All of this, these basic facts, are essential to understanding the plot, and there's no version in which any of the inferences are made explicit. So even in this unrealistic story world, you're making inferences all the time based on what you know is true. Perhaps the biggest objection to the reality assumption, however, is that it storifies too many things that are irrelevant. Every story is going to include vast collections of remote facts, unknown to the author, apparently immaterial to the narrative, right? So as long as nothing about the story excludes these domains, those things will obtain. So for example, it will be storified in Candide that 150 years after the events of the novel, there was a big earthquake in San Francisco. That was in the year 1906, which destroyed San Francisco. It will also be storified in Candide that the Higgs boson bestows mass on other subatomic particles. Why? Because it does, and nothing in Candide excludes those kinds of facts. And needless to say, neither Voltaire nor his intended audience could have had any idea about these kinds of facts. Now, in reply to this worry, I will say a couple of things. The first is that we're not mandated to imagine everything that is storified, right? It's storified in Candide, that Candide, Pangloss, and all the other characters have internal organs, that they breathe oxygen, that gravity keeps them on the ground. Okay? You don't have to think about that to appreciate the novel, but nonetheless, it is storified that that's the case. To say that something is storified is simply to say that it's available if you need it in order to make inferences to understand what's going on and to appreciate the story. It doesn't mean that you have to think about it explicitly. Those who want to restrict the notion of what is storified try to get it to be something that's relevant, right? Intuitively, facts about the Higgs boson are simply irrelevant to Candide, and therefore we want to exclude them from what's storified. Now, it is notoriously difficult here and in very many other areas to articulate what it means to be relevant. The usual way of trying to do this is in terms of the actual author or an implied author's intentions or beliefs, or what we assume to be intentions and beliefs that they might have had, the idea being that we take what is storified to be what the author or implied author is trying to get across to us, like a situation of communication. But I don't think that this works. Okay. First, we can't know in advance what truths might be relevant to appreciating a work of fiction, right? In chapter 5 of Candide, Voltaire describes the aftermath of the 1755 Lisbon earthquake. It's a very vivid scene, it's a real earthquake, and it's accurately described. That the Lisbon earthquake was followed by many more devastating earthquakes, like the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, which is often compared to the Lisbon earthquake, is relevant, I think, to appreciating Voltaire's argument in Candide, namely that this is not the best of all possible worlds. It's not like the 1755 earthquake was a one-off. Okay. Even though, obviously, Voltaire or reconstructed Voltaire couldn't have known. In addition, restricting what is storified to what could have been intended or believed by an author closes off interpretive options, I think. So consider John Rhys's novel, The Wide Sargasso Sea, from 1966, which develops a backstory for the character in Jane Eyre, known as the woman in the attic, Bertha Mason, Rochester's first wife. Before Rhys's novel came out, very few critics had thought that detailed aspects of the history of Jamaica were relevant to understanding Bronte's novel. It's true that Rochester married Mason in Jamaica, but it's left behind and not much is made of it in the novel, and so this wasn't really a topic of discussion. But after Wide Sargasso Sea came out, these facts, ordinary historical facts about what was actually happening in Jamaica at the time and the situation of Creoles, like the character Bertha Mason, have become important parts of critical discussion. And so if we were to restrict ourselves in these ways that are suggested by those who want something more relevant, we wouldn't get these interesting kinds of interpretations. Okay, so those are my replies to the objections, and now I just want to wrap up by returning to this question that I raised earlier about our patterns of criticism. All right, why do we criticize certain works of fiction for misrepresentation, but we don't criticize other works of fiction for misrepresentation. Okay. So, as I said, we criticize Philippa Gregory's The Other Boleyn Girl. Why does this novel get so much bad press when other works of fiction depart from the historical record significantly more? Right? Philip Roth's The Plot Against America imagines that Charles Lindbergh, the aviator, won the 1940 American election instead of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as a consequence of which the US never entered World War II, the Axis powers won, anti-Semitism and persecution spreads across the US, et cetera, et cetera. All these consequences from this counterfactual assumption. Nobody criticizes Roth, right, for completely changing what actually happened in the novel. And I think that the reason is straightforward in light of what I've said before. Right? The counterfactual elements of the plot against America fall outside of the scope of the reality assumption. We can see that the domain of the historical events subsequent to 1940 are excluded from what actually happened. Okay? We're not supposed to imagine those to be what really is true. By contrast, for good reasons that I can't get into now, we treat Gregory as trying to give us a picture of the real situation, the real personalities and events that happened during Tudor times, in particular with Anne Boleyn. And so we criticize her because we think that that remains within the scope of the reality assumption. And you can see the same thing happening within a single work, like Oliver Twist and Charles Dickens. So Dickens is praised, right, for telling us about the poor. He motivated a great deal of good works in Victorian times to help the poor and to help orphans, like Oliver Twist, right? But he's criticized, and he was criticized at the time, for his stereotypical portrayal of the character Fagin, frequently called the Jew, in the work, and whose bad features are typically associated with that ethnicity. Okay. And so I think that these patterns of criticism are explained by the fact that we start out, we assume it's the real world, and in some cases we adjust, and then we don't criticize. But in other cases we don't adjust because we recognize it's supposed to be accurate, and we do criticize. So, just to conclude, I think we have a good reason to take the reality assumption to specify the default place where we are when we interpret a work of fiction. We start out with the real world. And the question is why the reality assumption has this default status. And my answer is because we just take fictions to be about the real world. It's the natural place to start. We assume we're in the real world when we open the book. That's why we assume, by default, that everything that obtains in the real world obtains in the story world. But we know we're going to imagine that real world differently from how it is, and that's why we make various adjustments. So next time, I'm going to say something about why this explanation helps us understand why we care about fiction. So that's to come. Thank you.